historian. My latest book is called George III, The Life and Reign of Britain's Most Misunderstood Monarch.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. Why does history need reclaiming? It's an interesting, intriguing title for a website, but why did you want to be a member of this group?
Well, before I answer that, I'd just like to preface my remarks by saying what a great idea it is, and to congratulate the people like Robert Toombs who set it up. I'm really proud to be a member of History Reclaimed. And to answer your question, I think it's because there's been, in the last 20 years or so, perhaps less than that even, a new kind of viciousness that has entered the historical debate that really wasn't there before. I think in the past people really did concentrate on evidence and facts and try to base their opinions on documents and so on. And in the last 20 years, and I do blame critical race theory for this, there's been a concentrate instead on just motion and aggression and a sort of new way of looking at history, which is not empirical in my view.
Your paper on the History Reclaimed website is looking at Churchill's reputation. You wrote it following a panel discussion at Churchill College, Cambridge, his namesake college, in February 2021 this year. Why did you put pen to paper? Why did that panel discussion motivate you to say, hang on?
Well, it struck me that Churchill College, of all places, was deliberately going out of its way to trash the reputation of Winston Churchill. And it did this in a what was supposed to be an academic conference in which all four of the people taking part had one very anti-Churchill view, and nobody at all was there to put the other point of view. And it struck me that they were almost egging each other on to say the most outrageous things about Winston Churchill, such as that he was as bad as Adolf Hitler, which were revolting to hear, certainly for somebody like me who spent 30 years writing and researching about Winston Churchill and knows that to be a complete falsehood. And so it did annoy me, I have to say. There are a few things that raise me to fury, but hearing these dreadful lies spoken about somebody who I consider to be the greatest Englishman who ever lived was something that I didn't want to just let go by without having a riposte. And very fortunately, a Policy Exchange, the non-partisan think tank, was generously willing to host a paper written not just by me, but also by Zudito Gebriones, who is a very talented young writer as well. And she and I put together this document that really, argument by argument, refuted what was said at that conference.
And you put forward six chapters in that Policy Exchange paper. But which of those assertions in that panel discussion in February did you think most damaged Churchill's reputation? Was it the one that you said was saying that he was worse than Hitler?
No, I don't think most intelligent people recognise that that's a complete absurdity. So I don't think actually that was particularly damaging to him. All it did really was to draw attention to quite how extreme the views were of the people who'd been chosen to go on the panel. And so in that sense, and not all of whom were historians, by the way, and there were people who mixed up Anarin Bevin with Ernest Bevin and so on. So we weren't talking about the greatest Churchill experts by any means on this panel. But no, I think that much more concerning was the sheer rat-a-tat-tat of weird and very unpleasant views that came out throughout the entire 45 minutes or hour or so of the so-called conference. It wasn't really a conference, and it was very good of Churchill College, Cambridge, once they actually looked at what had gone out, to effectively repudiate it by cancelling the rest of the lecture series or the conference series. I thought that was sensible of them to appreciate the widespread sense of dismay that came from such a historically biased attack on the person who, after all, their college was named after.
If I can put you on the spot and return to some tabloid journalism now, because that speech did hit the national papers. But if you had to go through your six assertions that you challenged about that panel discussion one by one, one was the defeat of Hitler, another was Churchill's popularity, another was the West and Nazi identity, another was Churchill's racial views, another was the Bengali famine, and then Britain's legacy. Would you like to take me through, say, three of those that irritate you most?
Yes, all right, if I can remember them. I will start with the first one that you mentioned about Britain's role in the war. People on the panel basically said that Winston Churchill wasn't the key figure in the creation of British grand strategy, and that even if he was, Britain didn't do that much to win the war because it was all won on the Eastern Front by the Soviet Union. It strikes me as belittling Churchill's immense contribution to the creation of grand strategy, about which I've written books and which I think I know more about than anybody on that panel, certainly, because he was central to that. He was chair of the Defence Committee of the War Cabinet. And the other thing is that Britain actually made a huge, huge contribution to the victory in the Second World War. When the Soviet Union was allied to Adolf Hitler, we were, along with our empire and also with Greece, the only people in 1940 and 1941 who stood against Hitler. We then, in the combined bomber offensive, in the Battle of the Atlantic, in the struggle against the Japanese, and in so many other areas, were absolutely central to, and indeed in helping the Russians on the Eastern Front, as I mentioned earlier, were absolutely central to the victory, along with the Americans and, of course, the Russians and so many other allied countries. So that was one of the things that definitely got my goat. You mentioned the Bengal famine. This, too, is an absolute libel against Winston Churchill. Look at the papers and go back to the letters that he wrote to the Prime Ministers of Australia and New Zealand and the President of America. He was, and indeed the Viceroy of India, Wavell. He wanted to deal with that famine as best they possibly could, considering that the Japanese were in control of Burma and Thailand and Malaya and the places where in peacetime rice could be sent to Bengal. It was started by a massive typhoon that knocked out the rail and the road communications. And the idea that this was essentially made worse by Winston Churchill deliberately in order to kill as many Indians as possible is a disgraceful libel, and one that I hope I called out in my policy exchange paper that Zudita and I wrote. Give me a third one, any one of the other.
The one that hit the headlines was Churchill's racial views.
Yes, exactly. That's another aspect which has been wildly taken out of context. Yes, he did believe that there was a hierarchy of the races and that the white people were on top. He was born at the time that Charles Darwin was still alive, and it was considered a scientific fact, one that we know to be absurd and obscene today. But nonetheless, he spent his life protecting people. If you're to call somebody a racist, you actually have to believe not only that they had the views of the time, but also that they wanted bad things to happen to non-white people. And Churchill fought in campaign after campaign in the Sudan, in the South Africa, in Northwest, in the frontier of India, trying to prevent bad things happening to non-white people. You know, he fought to abolish slavery in the Sudan. He was fighting against the Afrikaners so badly oppressing non-white peoples of South Africa. He was protecting the Punjabi farmers up on the northwest frontier when he was fighting the Talib and the Afridi tribesmen. You know, this is just completely untrue to say that he was we had war criminal used as one of the epithets against him, mass murderer, these kind of things. All you have to do, really, is to go back to look at the evidence with a mind that is uncluttered by all this critical race theory rubbish and Marxist assumptions, and look and see what he genuinely actually did. And you can find that in any number of good books.
If I'm to challenge you now, Andrew, and not take through the reverse view of those you've just put. But surely all accounts of history need to be rewritten. That's the new order overturning the old guard. There has to be a challenge to history.
All of history is a revision. It's a good thing. You need to have history constantly being updated. And what History Reclaimed is doing is reclaiming the quality of history, reclaiming the way in which history is being rewritten. You need to have people who are rewriting it based on evidence, on facts, on statistics, on double-checked citations, on things that actually happened, as opposed to trying to shove the whole of the past into a preconceived ideological position, which is what the revisionists are doing. So you absolutely do need to have a full revision of history all the time, every day. It's impossible to stop it anyway. That's what progress does. That's what the development of history is all about. But you have to do it with, essentially, with academic quality, intellectual honesty. And that's what History Reclaimed is all about.
So in that case, in your book, should the panel discussion in February this year at Churchill College, talking about Churchill, have taken place? Or should it have been more balanced? You're not saying it shouldn't have taken place. You're saying...
No, I think the views of these people, of course, should be aired. Absolutely they should be aired, but they should be aired in such a way that there are people there who can take them apart piece by piece, as I believe that I did in the policy exchange paper, and hold them up to essentially to, you know, the sunlight of fact and truth. And that's not what happened. You had four people all agreeing with one another, egging each other on to make ever more outrageous and incorrect, factually incorrect remarks.
Would you have sat on that panel if you'd been asked? And would you sit on a panel with those other delegates?
Not if it was one against four, no. That, I'm afraid that happens far too often nowadays. It's happened to me several times and I'm bored of it. Being the one pro-Churchill person sitting, or in usually not just pro-Churchill, but pro-empire, pro pretty much anything that's considered politically incorrect nowadays, and being completely outnumbered. So you say a sentence and you have then four people jumping down your throat, and you don't get 50% of the time to respond, even though you have got 50% of the argument. I can completely understand why the airwaves are completely covered now by the loudest people rather than the most thoughtful ones.
Do you think this attack on Churchill and his reputation is part of what's called the culture war, so-called wokeness? Is this what was happening in February?
Of course, absolutely. It's the front line. Churchill and Churchill studies are on the absolute front line of the culture wars, which are unfortunately, they weren't brought on by the sensible people in the centre. They are a deliberate way of trying to wreck decent history, frankly. They have profound political overtones and undertones in mind.
But we're all entitled to express our opinions. You've said that.
Yes, of course we are. Absolutely.
And a bit off beam now, how would you like to see schools teaching history? It must be quite difficult for history teachers to tread a balanced path through the various views that are taking place now.
Yes, I hear all the time from teachers who feel nerve-wracked that anything that they say is going to be misinterpreted and treated politically and be essentially put them in the dock of wokery, and that they're not actually going to have a proper objective chance to put what really happened to their pupils. You see it a lot in universities, sadly, nowadays as well. I'm not going to name names because it's just getting them into trouble, but it happens on a, I would say, a weekly basis that I come into contact with somebody who feels that their freedom of speech as an educator is under a threat, at least today.
And your latest book, finally, Andrew, George III, you've reclaimed his reputation.
I hope so, yes. Well, this is another thing. This is why I'm not opposed to revising history. You know, I'm doing it myself with George III. I think he's a much misunderstood, underappreciated monarch. I think he was an enlightened figure, certainly. He was a Renaissance prince in many ways. And he's gone down as being one of the worst kings in British history, which is
mad. The film portrays him.
He was mad. Yeah, no, absolutely. He had five bouts of madness. That the last one was the last 10 years of his life. And, of course, there was a regency as a result. But if you add all the others together, they're not much over 12 months. And so the idea that, for example, we lost America because the king was mad is completely wrong. You know, he didn't have an attack between 1765 and 1788, and you know, we lost America between 1775 and 1783. So, you know, he was completely sane during all of that. But he was a constitutional monarch, and there were things he could and couldn't do. And he's been blamed for things that essentially, I hope I prove, were the fault of his ministers and his generals and his admirals.
And I think he had a very stable marriage and 15 children and cared about his staff and paying his bills.
Yes, unlike his son George IV, who had compulsive buying disorder and was spending at one point almost as much as the nation was spending on the Royal Navy. So we have an extraordinary, uxorious, decent, splendid, pious, a good-natured man being followed by somebody who genuinely was one of the worst kings in British history, George IV.
Andrew Roberts, thank you very much for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. I very much enjoyed talking to you.
You are kind. Thank you very much indeed.